Los Angeles. 100 years earlier, all the small towns and cities that comprise the San Fernando Valley were annexed into Los Angeles for one reason. The newly built Los Angeles Aqueduct offered bountiful supplies of water that would keep their rich agricultural fields from drying up and blowing away. One by one, they were added, and Los Angeles grew and spread north, eventually taking in the area's entire sprawl. All except for the 2.3 square miles of the valley's namesake, the city of San Fernando. The little town didn't need LA's water. Its ground supplies were more than adequate. Avoiding the overture of the big city that now surrounded it, it stayed independent. 100 years later, it remained so. The valley's agriculture pedigree may have long ago given way to urban sprawl and urban blight, but the city of San Fernando remained a quaint throwback to small-town sensibilities. Of course, urban issues and crime were unavoidable, but they were nothing the tiny town's police department couldn't routinely take care of. That is, until the financial crash of 2008. When the banking crisis happened, and economies constricted and spiraled downward around the world, it was only a few years before the tidal wave of financial pain hit San Fernando. Deep budget cuts occurred, and then occurred again. Police Chief Anthony Valdez saw his department drop from 40 sworn officers, including himself, in 2010, to 30 officers by 2016. He saw his detective squad of 5 investigators shrink to just 2. One detective to handle property crimes, and one to handle crimes against persons. Valdez saw cases start to pile up unsolved, some not even initially investigated fully and properly. Valdez was born and raised in San Fernando, but was seasoned as a cop with the LAPD, putting in 20 years and rising to the rank of captain before taking his pension and checking out, then landing the top spot at his hometown's department. His connections to the bigger department that surrounded his own ran deep, and his solution to the budget crisis was to expand SFPD's reserve program and bring in more officers who worked part-time hours, but for free. And it was this expansion that led Chief Valdez to Harry Bosch. One of Valdez's early assignments when he was with LAPD had been in a gang suppression unit in the Hollywood division. There he ran afoul of a lieutenant named Pounds, who filed an internal complaint and unsuccessfully attempted to have Valdez demoted or even fired. Valdez avoided both, and just a few months later heard about a detective named Bosch, who got himself into an altercation with Pounds and ended up throwing him through a plate glass window at Hollywood Station. Valdez always remembered that name, and years later when he read about a now-retired Harry Bosch suing the LAPD for forcing him out of his job on the cold case squad, he picked up the phone. Valdez couldn't offer Bosch a paycheck, but he could offer him something Bosch valued more. A detective's badge, and access to all of the tiny city's unsolved cases. The SFPD's reserve unit had only 3 requirements. Its officers had to maintain their state training standards as law enforcement officers, qualify once a month at the department's shooting range, and work at least 2 shifts a month. It was a no-brainer for Bosch. The LAPD didn't want or need him anymore, but the little town up in the valley certainly did. And there was work to be done and victims waiting for justice. Bosch took the job the moment it was offered. He knew it would allow him to continue his life's mission, and he needed no paycheck for that. Bosch easily met and surpassed the reserve officer minimums. It was rare that he didn't put in at least 2 shifts a week, let alone a month, in the detective bureau. He was there so often that he was permanently assigned one of the cubicles that had been left open when the squad was trimmed in the budget crunch. Most days he was working in the cubicle, or across First Street from the police station in the old city jail, where the cells were repurposed as storage rooms. The former drunk tank now housed 3 rows of standing shelves stocked with opened case files going back decades. Because of the statute of limitations on all crimes but murder, the great majority of these cases would never be solved or even examined. The small city didn't have a lot of murders. But Bosch was meticulously going through them, looking for ways to apply new technologies to old evidence. He also took on a review of all sexual assaults, non-fatal shootings, and attacks resulting in major injuries within the statute of limitations for those crimes. The job had a lot of freedom to it. Bosch could set his own hours and could always take time away if a case came up for him in private investigation. Chief Valdez knew he was lucky to have a detective with Bosch's experience working for him, and he never wanted to impinge on Bosch's ability to take on a paying job. He just stressed to Bosch that the two could never mix. Harry could not use his badge and access as a San Fernando cop to facilitate or further any private investigation. That would be a firing offense. Chapter 5. Murder knows no bounds or city limits. Most of the cases Bosch reviewed and pursued took him into LAPD turf. It was only expected. Two of the big city's police divisions shared borders with San Fernando, Mission Division to the west and Foothill Division to the east. In 4 months, Bosch had cleared 2 unsolved gang murders, connecting them through ballistics to murders in L.A., for which the perpetrators were already in prison, and linked a third to a pair of suspects already being sought for murder by the larger department. Additionally, Bosch had used M.O., modus operandi, and then DNA to connect 4 sexual assault cases in San Fernando over a 4-year period, and was in the process of determining whether the attacker was responsible for any rapes in Los Angeles as well. Driving the 210 away from Pasadena allowed Bosch to check for a tail. Midday traffic was light, and by alternately driving 5 miles below the speed limit, and then taking it up to 15 above it, he could check the mirrors for vehicles following the same pattern. He wasn't sure how seriously to take Whitney Vance's concerns about the secrecy of his investigation, but it didn't hurt to be alert to a tail. He didn't see anything on the road behind him. Of course, he knew that his car could have been tagged with a GPS tracker while he was in the mansion with Vance, or even the day before while he met with Creighton at the U.S. Bank Tower. He would need to check for that later. In 15 minutes, he had crossed the top of the valley and was back in L.A. He took the Maclay Street exit and dropped down into San Fernando, where he turned onto First Street. The SFPD was located in a single-story building with white stucco walls and a red barrel tile roof. The population of the tiny town was 90% Latino, and its municipal structures were all designed with a nod to Mexican culture. Bosch parked in the employee lot and used an electronic key to enter the station through the side door. He nodded to a couple of uniformed cops through the window of the report room and followed the back hallway past the chief's office toward the detective bureau.
Harry!
Bosch turned and looked through the door to the chief's office. Valdez was behind his desk, waving him in. Harry stepped into the office. It wasn't as big as the LAPD chief's suite, but it was comfortable and had a sitting area for informal discussions. Hanging from the ceiling was a black-and-white toy helicopter with SFPD painted on its body. The first time Bosch had been in the office, Valdez had explained that this was the department's helicopter, a joking reference to the fact that the department didn't have its own bird and had to call in air support when needed from the LAPD.
"How's it going?" Valdez asked.
"Can't complain," Bosch said.
"Well, we certainly appreciate what you're doing around here. Anything happening on the screen cutter?"
It was a reference to the serial rapist case Bosch had identified. "I'm about to go check on responses to our email. After that, I'll get with Bella to talk about next moves."
"I read the report from the profiler when I approved the payment. Interesting stuff. We gotta get this guy."
"Working on it."
"Okay. Well, I won't hold you up."
"Okay, Chief." Bosch glanced at the helicopter for a moment and then left the office. The detective bureau was just a few paces down the hall. By LAPD or any standards, it was quite small. It had once consisted of 2 rooms, but one room had been subleased to the county coroner's office as a satellite office for 2 of its investigators. Now there were 3 detective cubicles crammed into one room, with a closet-sized supervisor's office adjoining. Bosch's cubicle had 5-foot walls that allowed him privacy from 3 sides, but the 4th side was open to the office door of the squad supervisor. That post was supposed to be a full-time lieutenant slot, but it had been vacant since the budget crunch, and the supervisor was currently the department's only captain. His name was Trevino, and he had so far not been convinced that having Bosch on the premises and handling cases was a good thing.
He seemed suspicious of Bosch's motives for working so many hours for no pay and kept a careful watch over him. For Bosch, the only thing that alleviated this unwanted attention was that Trevino wore multiple hats in the department, as is often the case with small agencies. He was running the detective bureau and was also in charge of interior operations in the station, including the dispatch center, the indoor firing range, and the 16-bed jail built to replace the aging facility across the street. These responsibilities often drew Trevino out of the detective bureau and off Bosch's back. Bosch checked his mail slot upon entering and found a reminder notice that he was overdue qualifying this month on the range. He moved into his cubicle and sat down at his desk. Along the way, he saw that Trevino's door was closed and the glass transom above it was dark. The captain was most likely in another part of the building, carrying out one of his other duties. Bosch thought he understood Trevino's suspicion and lack of welcome. Any success he had in clearing cases could be seen as a failing on Trevino's part. After all, the detective bureau was currently his domain, and it didn't help when word got around that Bosch had once thrown his LAPD supervisor through a plate glass window. Still, there was nothing Trevino could do about Bosch's placement in the office, because he was part of the police chief's effort to overcome personnel cuts. Bosch turned on his computer terminal and waited for it to boot up. It had been 4 days since he was last in the office. A flyer for a department bowling night had been left on his desk, and he immediately transferred this to the recycle bin beneath it. He liked the people he worked with the new department, but he wasn't much of a bowler. Using a key to open a locked file cabinet in his desk, he pulled out a few folders pertaining to open cases he was working and spread them on his desk so it would appear he was engaged in SFPD business. He noticed when he reached for his screen cutter folder that it wasn't there. He found it in the wrong spot in the drawer. It had been misfiled under the first victim's name rather than under the unknown suspect's moniker, Screen Cutter. This immediately alarmed and annoyed Bosch. He didn't believe he could have misfiled the case. All of his career, he had carefully managed his case files. The file, whether it was a murder book or a manila folder, was the heart of the case, and it always needed to be neatly and thoroughly put together and safely stored. He put the folder on his desk and considered that someone with a duplicate key might be reading his files and checking his work. And he knew exactly who that might be. He reversed himself and returned all his files to the drawer, then closed and locked it with his key. He had a plan for smoking out the intruder. He sat up straight to look over the partitions and saw that both of the other detectives' cubicles were empty. Bella Lourdes, the CAP's investigator, and Danny Sisto, who handled property crimes, were probably out in the field following up on crime reports. They often went out to handle much of their field work together. Once he was logged into the department's computer system, Bosch opened up the law enforcement database. He got out his notebook and began the search for Viviana Duarte. Knowing he was breaking the rule the police chief had given him, using his SFPD access to supplement a private investigation. Not only was it a firing offense at SFPD, but it was a crime in California to access a law enforcement database for information not pertaining to a police investigation. If Trevino ever decided to audit Bosch's use of the computer, there would be a problem. But Bosch figured that would not happen. Trevino would know that if he made a move against Bosch, he was making a move against the police chief. And that was most likely career suicide. The search for Viviana Duarte was short. There was no listing of her ever having a driver's license in California, no record of her ever committing a crime or even getting a parking ticket. Of course, the digital databases were less complete the farther back the search went, but Bosch knew from experience that it was rare not to find any reference to an entered name. It supported the possibility that Duarte had been an illegal and possibly returned to Mexico in 1950 after becoming pregnant. Abortion in California was against the law back then. She might have crossed the border to have her baby, or to have the pregnancy terminated in one of the backroom clinics in Tijuana. Bosch knew the law on abortion back then because he had been born in 1950 to an unmarried woman, and soon after becoming a cop, he had looked up the laws so that he would better understand the choices his mother had faced and made. What he was not familiar with was the California Penal Code in 1950. He accessed it next and checked the laws about sexual assault. He pretty quickly learned that in 1950, under Penal Code Section 261, sexual intercourse with a female under age 18 was considered a chargeable offense of rape. Consensual relations were not listed as an exclusion to prosecution. The only exclusion offered was if the woman was the wife of the offender. Bosch thought about Vance's father, believing the pregnancy was a trap set by Duarte to force a marriage that would bring her citizenship and money. If that was the case, the penal code gave her a solid piece of leverage. But the lack of any record of Duarte in California seemed to belie that angle. Rather than use her leverage, Duarte had disappeared, possibly back to Mexico. Bosch switched the screen again, went back to the DMV interface, and typed in James Franklin Aldridge, the cover name Vance had given him. Before the results came up, he saw Captain Trevino enter the squad room, carrying a cup of coffee from Starbucks. Bosch knew there was a store located a few blocks away on Truman. He often took a break from computer work in the bureau and walked over himself. This was not only to give his eyes a rest, but to indulge in a recent addiction to iced lattes that had developed since he began routinely meeting with his daughter at various coffee shops near her school campus.
"Harry, what brings you in today?" Trevino said.
The captain always greeted him cordially, and by his first name. "I was in the neighborhood," Bosch said. "Thought I'd check email, send out a few more alerts on the screen cutter." As he spoke, he killed the DMV screen and pulled up the email account he had been given by the department. He didn't turn around as Trevino went to the door of his office and unlocked it. Bosch heard the door open, but then felt Trevino's presence behind him in the cubicle.
"In the neighborhood," Trevino said, "all the way up here, and all dressed up in a suit."
"Well, actually, I was in Pasadena seeing somebody, and then I just took the foothill across," Bosch said. "Thought I'd just send out a few emails, then get out of here."
"Your name's not on the board, Harry. You have to sign in to get credit for your hours."
"Sorry, I was only going to be here a few minutes, and I don't have to worry about making my hours. I put in 24 last week alone."
There was an attendance board by the entrance to the detective bureau on which Bosch had been instructed to sign in and out so Trevino could chart his hours and make sure he hit the reserve officer minimum.
"I still want you signing in and out," Trevino said.
"You got it, Cap," Bosch said.
"Good. By the way..."
Bosch reached down and rapped his knuckles on the file drawer.
"I forgot my key," he said. "You have a key I can open this with? I need my files."
"No, no key. Garcia turned in the only one. He said that was all he got from Dockweiler."
Bosch knew that Garcia was the last detective to occupy the desk, and that he had inherited it from Dockweiler. Both were casualties of the budget crunch. He heard in the office scuttlebutt that both men left law enforcement after being laid off. Garcia became a school teacher, and Dockweiler saved his city paycheck and pension by transferring to the Public Works Department, where they had an opening in code enforcement.
"Anybody else have a key around here?" Bosch asked.
"Not that I know of," Trevino said. "Why don't you just open it with your lockpicks, Harry?
Hey, you're good with those."
He said it with a tone that implied that Bosch was somehow skilled in the dark arts because he knew how to pick a lock.
"Yeah, I might do that," Bosch said. "Thanks for the idea."
Trevino stepped into his office, and Bosch heard the door close. He made a mental note to check with Dockweiler about the missing key. He wanted to make sure the former detective didn't have it before he took any steps toward proving Trevino was the one secretly checking his files. Bosch reopened the DMV portal to run Aldridge's name. He soon pulled up a history that showed Aldridge had a California driver's license from 1948 until 2002, at which point it was surrendered when the license holder moved to Florida. He wrote down Aldridge's date of birth and then entered it with his name on a check of the Florida DMV database. This determined that Aldridge had surrendered his license in Florida at age 80. The last address listed was in a place called the Villages. After writing down the information, Bosch checked for a website and found that the Villages was a massive retirement community in Sumner County, Florida. Further searching of online records found an address for Aldridge, and no indication of a death record or obituary.
He had likely surrendered his driver's license, because he no longer could or needed to drive, but it appeared that James Franklin Aldridge was still alive. Curious about the incident that supposedly got Aldridge kicked out of USC, Bosch next ran the name through the crime database, doubling down on his firing offenses for the day. Aldridge had a DUI on his record from 1986, and that was it. Whatever had happened back in his freshman year of college remained hidden from Bosch. Content that he had sufficiently chased down the name as needed for a possible cover story, Bosch decided to check through the email that had accumulated on the screencutter case. It was the investigation that had consumed most of his time since he had joined the ranks of the San Fernando Police Department. He had worked serial murder cases before during his time with LAPD, and most, if not all, had a sexual component to them, so the territory was not new to Bosch. But the screencutter case was one of the more puzzling cases he had ever encountered. Chapter 6 Screencutter was the case name for the serial rapist Bosch had identified among the department's open sexual assault reports. Combing through the files in the Old City Jail, Bosch had found four cases since 2012 that were seemingly related by M.O., but previously not seen as connected. The cases shared five suspect behaviors that alone were not unusual, but when taken as a whole indicated the strong possibility of one perpetrator at work. In each case, the rapist had entered the victim's home through a rear door or window after cutting the screen rather than removing it. All four assaults occurred during the day and within 50 minutes before or after noon. The rapist used a knife to cut the victim's clothes off rather than ordering her to remove them. In each case, the rapist wore a mask, a ski mask in two attacks, a Freddy Krueger Halloween mask in a third, and a Mexican Lucha Libre wrestling mask in the fourth. And finally, the rapist used no condom or other method to avoid leaving his DNA behind. With these commonalities in hand, Bosch focused an investigation on the four cases and soon learned that while the suspect's semen had been collected in rape kits in three of the four cases, only in one instance had the material actually been analyzed in the L.A. County Sheriff's Crime Lab and submitted for comparison to state and national DNA databases, where it found no match. Analysis in the two most recent cases was delayed because of a backlog of rape kits submitted to the county lab for examination. In the fourth case, which was actually the first reported rape, a rape kit was collected, but no DNA from the rapist was found in the vaginal swab, because the victim had showered and douched before calling police to report the assault. The county lab and the LAPD lab shared the same building at Cal State LA, and Bosch used his connections from his cold case days to speed up analysis of the two recent cases. While he awaited the results, he thought he would solidly connect the cases. He began requesting follow-up interviews of the victims. Each of the victims, three women in their 20s, and now an 18-year-old, agreed to meet with the detectives. On two of the cases, he would have to turn over the questioning to Bella Lourdes, because it was noted that the victims preferred to do the interviews in Spanish. It underlined the one drawback for Bosch in working cases in a city where 9 out of every 10 citizens were Latino and had varying capabilities when it came to English. He spoke Spanish, passably, but for an interview with a crime victim, where subtle nuances of storytelling might be important, he needed Lourdes, who understood it as a first language. To each meeting, Bosch brought a copy of a victim questionnaire used by LAPD investigators who worked violent crimes. It was 9 pages of questions, designed to help identify habits of the victim that might have drawn the attention of the offender. The questionnaires were helpful in serial investigations, particularly in profiling the offender, and Bosch had cached a copy from a Hollywood Division sex crimes investigator who was a friend. The questionnaire became the stated purpose of the new round of interviews, and the stories that emerged were equal parts sad and terrifying. These were undoubtedly stranger rapes, and the attacks had left each woman recovering both mentally and physically as long as 4 years after the crime. They all lived in fear of their attacker returning, and none had recovered the confidence they once had. One of them had been married, and at the time was trying to conceive a child. The attack changed things in the marriage, and at the time of the follow-up interview, The couple were in the midst of divorce proceedings. After each interview, Bosch felt depressed and couldn't help but think about his own daughter and what sort of impact such an assault would have on her. Each time he called her within the hour to check that she was safe and okay, unable to tell her the true reason he was calling. But the follow-up interviews did more than reopen wounds for the victims. They helped focus the investigation and underlined the urgent need to identify and arrest the screen cutter. Bosch and Lourdes adopted a conversational approach to each victim that started with assurances that the case was still being investigated as a priority by the department. They scheduled the interviews in chronological order of the assaults. The first woman was the victim from whom no DNA evidence had been collected. The initial report on the crime explained that the woman had taken a shower and douched immediately after the attack out of fear that she would become pregnant. She and her husband at the time were trying to conceive a child, and she knew that the day of the attack was also the day that she was most fertile in her ovulation cycle. The victim was still separated by almost 4 years from the attack, and while the psychological trauma persisted, she had found coping mechanisms that allowed her to talk more openly about what was the worst single hour of her life. She described the attack in detail and revealed that she had attempted to dissuade the suspect from raping her by lying and saying she was having her period. The woman told Bosch and Lourdes that the man replied, "No, you're not. Your husband's coming home early to fuck you and make a baby." This was new information, and it gave the investigators pause. The woman confirmed that her husband was scheduled to come home early that day from the bank where he worked so that they could have an evening of romance, with the hope that it would result in her pregnancy. The question was, how did the screen cutter know that? Under questioning from Lourdes, the victim revealed that she had an app on her cell phone that tracked her menstrual cycle and told her the day of the month when she was ovulating and most likely to conceive. It was then her practice to transfer this information to a calendar kept on the refrigerator door. Each month she marked the day with red hearts and phrases like, "baby time," so her husband would be reminded of its significance. On the day of the attack, the woman had gone out to walk her dog in the neighborhood and was away from her home no more than 15 minutes. She had her phone with her. The screen cutter had gained entrance to the house, and when she returned, he was waiting for her. At knife point, he made her lock the dog in a bathroom, and then took her into a bedroom where the assault took place. Bosch wondered whether those 15 minutes she was walking the dog were enough time for the screen cutter to break into the house, see the calendar on the refrigerator, and understand its meaning to the point that he could make the comment to her about knowing what she and her husband had planned for the day. Bosch and Lourdes discussed this, and both felt it was more likely that the rapist had been in the house previously, either as part of stalking the victim, or because he was a family friend, or relative, or a repairman, or someone who had some other business there. This theory was supported when the other victims were interviewed, and an eerie new component to the screen cutter's MO was established. In each case, there were indicators inside the victim's home that revealed details of her menstrual cycle. In each case as well, the assault had taken place during what would have normally been the ovulation phase of each woman's cycle. The second and third victims revealed during the interviews that they used birth control pills that were dispensed from push-through pill cards. One of the women kept her pill card in a medicine cabinet, and the other in her bedside table. While the pills suppressed the ovulation cycle, the cards and the color coding of the pills could be used to chart when that 5 to 7 day phase would normally occur. The last victim had been attacked the February before. She was 16 years old at the time and home alone on a school holiday. The girl reported that at 14, she had been diagnosed with juvenile diabetes, and her menstruation cycle affected her insulin needs. She tracked her cycle on a calendar on the door of her bedroom so she and her mother could prepare the proper insulin dosage. The similarity in the timing of each of the attacks was clear. Each victim was assaulted during what normally would be the ovulation phase of their cycle, the time when a woman is most fertile. For this to have occurred in 4 out of 4 cases seemed beyond coincidence to Bosch and Lourdes. A profile began to emerge. The rapist had obviously carefully chosen the day of each attack. While information about each victim's cycle could be found inside her home, the attacker had to know this information beforehand. This meant he had stalked his victims, and likely had previously been in their homes. Additionally, it was clear from descriptions of the attacker's body that he was not Hispanic. The two victims who spoke no English said he gave them orders in Spanish, but it was clearly not his first language. The connections between the cases seem stunning and raise serious questions about why the cases had not been linked before Bosch arrived as a volunteer investigator. The answers were rooted in the department's budget crisis. The assaults occurred while the detective bureau was shrinking in size, and those left in the squad had more cases to work and less time to work them. Different investigators initially handled each of the four rapes. The first two investigators were gone when the second two cases occurred. There was no cohesive understanding of what was going on. There was no constant supervision in the squad either. The lieutenant's position was frozen, and those duties were assigned to Captain Trevino, who had responsibilities in other areas of the department as well. The connections Bosch identified between the cases were confirmed when the DNA results came back linking the three cases in which semen had been collected. There was now no doubt that a serial rapist had struck at least four times in 4 years in tiny San Fernando. Bosch also believed that there were more victims. In San Fernando alone, there was an estimated population of 5,000 illegal immigrants, half of them women, and many who would not call the police if victimized by crime. It also seemed unlikely that such a predator would operate only within the bounds of the tiny city. Four known victims were Latinas and had similar psychological appearances, long brown hair, dark eyes, and a slight build. None of them weighed more than 110 pounds. The two contiguous LAPD geographic divisions had majority Latino populations, and Bosch had to assume that there were more victims to be found there. Since discovering the connection between the cases, he had been spending almost all of his time on the SFPD job, making contact with investigators from LAPD's burglary and sexual assault squads throughout the valley, as well as in the nearby departments in Burbank, Glendale, and Pasadena. He was interested in any open cases involving screen cutting and the use of masks. So far, nothing had come back, but he knew it was a matter of getting detectives interested and looking, maybe getting the message to the right detective who would remember something. With the police chief's approval, Bosch had also contacted an old friend who had been a senior profiler with the FBI's Behavioral Analysis Unit. Bosch had worked with Megan Hill on several occasions when he was with the LAPD and she was with the Bureau. She was now retired from the FBI and working as a professor of forensic psychology at the John Jay College of Criminal Justice in New York. She also kept her hand in profiling as a private consultant. She agreed to look at Bosch's case for a discounted rate, and he sent her a package on the screen cutter. He was keenly interested in knowing the motivation and psychology behind the attacks. Why did the screen cutter's stalking pattern include determining his intended victim's ovulation phase? If he was trying to impregnate his victims, why did he choose two women who were taking birth control pills? There was something missing in the theory, and Bosch hoped the profiler would see it. Hill took 2 weeks to get back to Bosch, and her assessment of the cases concluded that the perpetrator was not choosing the attack dates because he wished to impregnate his victims. Quite the opposite. The details of the stalking and subsequent attacks revealed a subject with a deep-seated hatred of women and disgust toward the bodily ritual of bleeding. The day of the attack is chosen because the victim is considered by the offender to be at the cleanest part of her cycle. For him, psychologically, it is the safest moment for him to attack. Hill added to the profile of the rapist by describing him as a narcissistic predator with above-average intelligence. It was likely, however, that he had a job that did not involve intellectual stimulus and allowed him to fly below the radar when it came to the assessment of his employers and co-workers. The offender also had a high degree of confidence in his skill at eluding identification and capture. The crimes involved careful planning and waiting, and yet were marked by what seemed to be a critical mistake in leaving his semen in the victim. Discounting that this was part of an intention to impregnate, Hill concluded that it was intended to taunt. The offender was giving Bosch all the evidence he needed to convict him. Bosch just had to find him. Hill also focused on the seeming incongruity of the offender, leaving probative evidence of identity behind. His semen, and yet committing the crimes while masking his visual identity. She concluded that the offender might be someone the victims had previously met or seen, or he intended to make contact with them in some manner following the attacks, possibly deriving some of his satisfaction from getting close to the victims again. Megan Hill's profile ended with an ominous warning. If you eliminate the idea that the perpetrator's motive is to give life, impregnate, and realize that the attack is urged by hate, then it is clear that this subject has not concluded his evolution as predator. It is only a matter of time before these rapes become kills. The warning resulted in Bosch and Lourdes upping the game. They started by sending out another set of emails to local and national law enforcement agencies, with Hill's assessment attached. On the local level, they followed up with phone calls in an effort to break through the typical law enforcement inertia that descends on investigators who have too many cases and too little time. The response was close to nothing. One burglary detective from LAPD's North Hollywood Division reported that he had an open burglary case involving a screen cutting, but there was no rape involved. The detective said the victim was a male Hispanic, 26 years old. Bosch urged the investigator to go back to the victim to see if he had a wife or girlfriend who might have been attacked, but was afraid or embarrassed to report the assault. A week later, the LAPD detective reported back and said there was no female living in the apartment. The case was unconnected. Bosch was now playing a waiting game. The rapist's DNA was not in the databases. He had never been swabbed. He had left no fingerprints or other evidence behind other than his semen. Bosch found no other connecting cases in San Fernando or elsewhere. The debate over whether to go public with the case and ask for help of citizens was simmering on the back burner in the office of Chief Valdez. It was an age-old law enforcement question. Go public and possibly draw a lead that breaks the case open and leads to an arrest? Or go public and possibly alert the predator, who changes up his patterns or moves on and visits his tear on an unsuspecting community somewhere else? In the screen cutter case, Bosch and Lourdes had conflicting views. Lourdes wanted to go public, if only to chase the rapist out of San Fernando, if the move produced no leads. Bosch wanted more time to quietly look for him. He felt that going public would indeed chase him out of town, but that it would not stop the victim count. Predators didn't stop until they were caught. They just adapted and continued, moving like sharks to the next victim. Bosch didn't want to move the threat to another community. He felt a moral obligation to chase the suspect down here, where he was active. But there was no right answer, of course, and the chief appeared to be waiting, hoping that Bosch would come through and break the case before another victim was attacked. Bosch was ultimately relieved not to have the decision on his shoulders. He figured this is why the chief made the big bucks, and he made none. Bosch checked his email now and saw he had no new messages in his queue with the screen cutter in the subject line. Disappointed, he shut down the computer. He put his notebook back in his pocket and wondered if Trevino had looked down on it while hovering in the cubicle. It had been opened to the page with James Franklin Aldridge's name written on it. He left the squad room without bothering to say goodbye to Trevino or write his time down on the board at the front door. Chapter 7. After leaving the station, Bosch got on the 5 freeway and turned back to the Whitney Vance case. Not coming up with any birth date or other information on Viviana Duarte on the DMV database was disappointing, but no more than a temporary setback. Bosch was headed south to Norwalk, where the time travel gold mine was housed. The Los Angeles County Department of Public Health, the place he spent so much time as a cold case investigator in the vital records office, that he knew exactly how the clerks liked their coffee. He felt confident he would be able to answer some questions about Viviana Duarte there. Bosch put a CD in the Jeep's music slot and started listening to a young horn player named Christian Scott. The first track up, Litany Against Fear, had a relentless sound and drive to it, and that's what Bosch felt he needed at the moment. It took him an hour to get down to Norwalk after a slow crawl around the east edge of downtown. He pulled into the lot fronting the 7-story county building and killed the engine while Scott was in the middle of Naima, which Bosch thought compared favorably with John Handy's classic version recorded 50 years earlier. Just as he stepped out of the car, his cell phone chirped and he checked the screen. It said unknown caller, but he took it anyway. It was John Creighton, and the call was not a surprise. "So you saw Mr. Vance?" he asked. "I did," Bosch answered. "Well, how did it go?" "It went fine." Bosch was going to make Creighton dig for it. It might be considered passive-aggressive behavior on his part, but he was keeping the wishes of his client in mind. "Is there anything we can help with?"
No, I think I can handle it. Mr. Vance wants to keep it confidential, so I'll just leave it at that."
There was a long silence before Creighton spoke next.
"Harry," he said, "you and I go way back to the department, and of course Mr. Vance and I go way back as well. As I said yesterday before hiring you, he's an important client of this firm, and if there's anything wrong regarding his comfort and security, then I need to know it. I was hoping, as a former brother in blue, you might share with me what is going on. Mr. Vance is an old man. I don't want him taken advantage of."
"By taken advantage of? Are you talking about me?" Bosch asked.
"Of course not, Harry. Poor choice of words. What I mean is, if the old man is being extorted or otherwise facing any sort of trouble involving the need for a private detective, well, we are here, and we have enormous resources at our fingertips. We need to be brought in."
Bosch nodded. He expected this sort of play from Creighton after the demand in his office to be looped in.
"Well," he said, "all I can tell you is that, first of all, you didn't hire me. You were the bagman. You delivered money to me. Mr. Vance hired me, and that's who I work for. Mr. Vance was very specific and even had me sign a legal document agreeing to follow his instructions. He told me not to share with anyone what I'm doing or why I'm doing it. That would include you. If you want me to break from that, I need to call him back and ask for his per—"
"That won't be necessary," Creighton said quickly. "If that's how Mr. Vance wants it, that's fine. Just know we are here to help if needed."
"Absolutely," Bosch said in an upbeat but phony voice. "I'll call you if needed, John, and thanks for checking in."
He disconnected the call before Creighton could respond. He then headed through the parking lot toward the massive rectangular building that contained the records of all official births and deaths in L.A. County. All records of marriage and divorce were recorded here as well. The building always reminded Bosch of a giant treasure chest. The information was in there, if you knew where to look, or knew somebody who did. For those who didn't, the front steps of the building were where hawkers stood by, ready to counsel the uninitiated on how to fill out request forms, all for the price of a few dollars. Some of them already had the forms in their briefcases. It was a cottage industry built on the naivete and fear of those who find themselves venturing into the maw of government bureaucracy. Bosch jogged up the steps, ignoring those who came at him asking if he was applying for a fictitious business name or a marriage license. He entered and walked past the information booth and then towards the stairs. Knowing from experience that waiting for an elevator in the building could suck the will to live out of a person, he took the stairs down to the basement level, where the BDM section of the Register Recorder's office was located. As he pushed through the glass door, there was a shriek from one of the desks lining the wall on the other side of the public counter where birth, death, and marriage records could be requested. A woman stood up and smiled broadly at Bosch. She was Asian, and her name was Flora. She had always been most helpful to Bosch when he had carried a badge.
"Harry Bosch," she called out.
"Flora," he called right back. Along the counter there was a window for law enforcement requests, which were always given priority, and 2 windows for citizen requests.
There was a man standing at one of the citizen windows looking at copies of records. Bosch stepped up to the other. Flora was already heading to the law enforcement window.
No, you come down here, she instructed.
Bosch did as instructed, and then leaned over the counter for an awkward embrace.
I knew you'd come back to us here, Flora said.
Sooner or later, right, he said. But hey, I'm here as a citizen right now. I don't want to get you in any trouble. Bosch knew he could pull the San Fernando badge, but he didn't want to move like that to possibly track back to Valdez or Trevino. That would cause problems he didn't need. Instead, he started back to the citizen's window, choosing to keep his private and public detective work separate.
It's no trouble, Flora said. Not for you.
He ended the charade and remained at the LE window.
Well, this one might take a while, he said. I don't have all the information, and I need to go way, way back.
Let me try. What do you want?
Bosch always had to guard against chopping his language the way she did. His natural inclination was to start leaving out words when he spoke to her. He had caught himself doing it in the past, and he tried to avoid doing it now.
He pulled out his notebook and looked at some of the dates he had written down that morning in Vance's office.
Looking for a birth record, he said while reading. Talking about 1933 or 34. What do you have going that far back?
Not on database, Flora said. We have film here only. No hard record anymore. Let me see name.
He knew that she was talking about records transferred to microfilm in the 1970s and never updated to the computerized database. He turned his notebook around so she could see the name and spelling of Viviana Duarte. Bosch hoped that he would catch a break with the unusualness of it. At least it wasn't a common Latino surname like Garcia or Fernandez. There probably weren't too many Vivianas around either.
She old, Flora said. You want death too?
I do, but I have no idea when and if she died. Last time I have her alive for sure is June 1950. She made a frowning face.
Ooh, I see, Harry.
Thanks, Flora. Where is Paula? She still here? Paula was the other clerk he remembered from his frequent forays to the basement while a detective. Locating witnesses and families of victims was a key part of cold case investigation, usually the foundation of any case. The first thing you did was alert the family that the case was back under active investigation. But murder books from old cases rarely contained updates on deaths, marriages, and the migration of people. Consequently, Bosch did some of his best detective work in the halls of records and libraries.
Paula out today, Flora said. Just me. I write down now, and you get coffee. This take time.
Flora wrote down what she needed. Do you want a coffee, Flora? Bosch asked.
No, you get, she said. For waiting.
Then I think I'll just stick around. I filled up this morning, and I have stuff to do. He pulled out his phone and held it up by way of explanation. Flora went back into the microfilm archives to hunt. Bosch sat down on one of the plastic seats in an unused microfilm cubicle. He was thinking about next moves. Depending on what he came up with here, his next step was to go to St. Viviana's to see if he could get a look at baptismal records, or to the main library downtown, where they kept phone directories going back decades. Bosch pulled up his phone search app and typed in USC EVK to see what might come up. It got a hit right away. The EVK was still operating on the campus and was located in the Bernkrant Residential College on 34th Street. He pulled the address up on his Maps app and was soon looking at an overview of the sprawling campus just south of downtown. Vance said Viviana had lived only a few blocks from the EVK and walked to work. The campus ran along Figueroa Street in the Harbor Freeway corridor. This limited the number of residential streets in the area with direct access to the EVK. Bosch started writing them down, along with address spans, so he might be able to place the Duarte house when he checked the old phone directories at the Central Library. It soon occurred to him that he was looking at a 2016 map of the campus and its surroundings, and that the Harbor Freeway might not even have existed in 1950. That would give the neighborhood around USC a completely different makeup. He went back to the search app and pulled up the history of the freeway, also known as the 110,
which slash an 8-lane diagonal across the county from Pasadena down to the harbor. He soon learned that it was built in sections in the 1940s and 50s. It was the dawn of the freeway era in L.A., and the 110 was the very first project. The section that edged the east side of the USC campus was begun in 1952 and completed 2 years later, both dates well after the time Whitney Vance attended the school and met Viviana Duarte. Bosch went back to his mapping and started including streets that in 1949 and 1950 still provided walking access to the northeast corner of the campus where the EVK was located. Soon he had a list of 14 streets with a 4-block range of address numbers. At the library, he would first look up the name Duarte in the old directories and see if any were located on the streets and blocks on the list. Back then, almost everybody was listed in the phone book, if they had a phone. He was leaning over his phone's small screen checking the map for side streets he might have missed when Flora came back from the bowels of the record center. She was carrying one spool for the microfilm machine triumphantly up in her hand, and that immediately put a charge in Bosch's bloodstream. Flora had found Viviana. "She not born here," Flora said. "Mexico." This confused Bosch. He stood up and headed to the counter. "How do you know that?" he asked. "It say on her death certificate," Flora said. "Loreto." Flora had pronounced the name wrong, but Bosch understood it. He had once traced a murder suspect to Loreto, far down the inner coast of the Baja Peninsula. He guessed if he went there now, he would find a St. Viviana's cathedral or church. "You already found her death certificate?" he asked. "Not taking long," Flora said. "Only looked to 1951. Her words sucked the air out of Bosch. Viviana was not only dead, but dead so long. He had heard her name for the first time less than 6 hours ago, but already he had found her, in a way. He wondered how Vance would react to the news. He held his hand out for the microfilm reel. As Flora handed it to him, she told him the record number he should look for, 51-459. Bosch recognized it as a low number, even for 1951, the 459th death recorded in L.A. County that year. How far into the year could that be? A month? Two? A fleeting thought came to him. He looked at Flora. Had she read the cause of death when she found the document? "She died in childbirth?" he asked. Flora looked puzzled. No, she said. "But you read, make sure." Bosch took the spool and turned back to the machine. He quickly threaded the film through and turned on the projection light. There was an automatic feed controlled with a button. He sped through the documents, stopping every few seconds to check the record number stamped at the top corner. He was halfway through February before he got to the 459th death. When he found the document, he saw that the state of California certificate of death had not changed much over the decades. It might have been the oldest such document he had ever looked at, but he was intimately familiar with it. His eyes dropped down to the section the coroner or attending physician filled in. The cause of death was handwritten. Strangulation by ligature. Clothesline, due to suicide. Bosch stared for a long time at the line without moving or breathing. Viviana had killed herself. No details were written beyond what he had already read. There was just a signature too scribbled to decipher, followed by the printed words, "Deputy Coroner." Bosch leaned back and took in air. He felt immense sadness come over him. He didn't know all the details. He had heard only Vance's view of the story. An 18-year-old's experience, filtered through the frail and guilty memory of an 85-year-old. But he knew enough to know what had happened to Viviana wasn't right. Vance had left her on the wrong side of goodbye, and what happened in June brought about what happened in February. Bosch had a gut feeling that Viviana's life was taken from her long before she put the rope around her neck. The death certificate offered details that Bosch wrote down. Viviana took her life on February 12, 1951. She was 17. Her next of kin was listed as her father, Victor Duarte. His address was on Hope Street.
which had been one of the streets Bosch had written down after studying the map of the USC neighborhood. The street name seemed like a sad irony now. The lone curiosity on the document was the location of death. There was only an address on North Occidental Boulevard. Bosch knew that Occidental was west of downtown near Echo Park, and not at all close to Viviana's home neighborhood. He opened his phone and typed the address into the search app. It came back as the address of St. Helen's Home for Unwed Mothers. The search provided several websites associated with St. Helen's and a link to a 2008 story in the Los Angeles Times, marking the 100th anniversary of the facility. Bosch quickly pulled up the link and started reading the story. Maternity Home Marks 100th Birthday by Scott B. Anderson, staff writer. St. Helen's Home for Unwed Mothers is marking its 100th birthday this week with a celebration that honors its evolution from a place of family secrets to a center for family life. The 3-acre complex near Echo Park will be the site of a full week of programs, including a family picnic and featuring an address from a woman who more than 50 years ago was forced by family to give up her newborn for adoption at the center. Just as social mores have changed in the last few decades, so has St. Helen's. Getting prematurely pregnant once resulted in the mother being hidden away, delivering a child in secret, and then having that child immediately taken away for adoption. Bosch stopped reading as he came to understand what had happened 65 years ago to Viviana Duarte. "She had the baby," he whispered, "and they took it away from her." Chapter 8. Bosch looked over at the counter. Flora was looking at him strangely.
"Harry, you okay?" she asked.
He got up without answering and came to the counter. "Flora, I need birth records for the first 2 months of 1951, he said.
"Okay," she said. "What name?"
"I'm not sure. Duarte or Vance. I'm not sure how it would be listed. Give me your pen and I'll write it down."
"Okay."
"The hospital would be St. Helens. In fact, I want to look at all births at St. Helens, the first two."
"No. No St. Helen Hospital in L.A. County."
"It's not exactly a hospital. It's for unwed mothers."
"No record here, then."
"What are you talking about? There has to be a..."
"Record secret. When a baby is born, get adopted, new certificate come in, and no mention of St. Helen, you see?"
Bosch wasn't sure if he was tracking what she was trying to tell him. He knew there were all kinds of privacy laws protecting adoption records. "You're saying they don't file the birth certificate until after the adoption?" he asked.
"Exactly," Flora said.
"And it only has the names of the new parents on it?"
"Uh-huh. True."
"And the baby's new name?" Flora nodded. "What about the hospital? They lie about that."
"They say home birth."
In frustration, Bosch slapped his hands down flat on the counter. "So there is no way I can find out who her child was."
"I'm sorry, Harry. Don't be mad."
"I'm not mad, Flora. At least not at you."
"You good detective, Harry Bosch. You figure it out."
"Yeah, Flora. I'll figure it out." Hands still on the counter, Bosch leaned down and tried to think. There had to be a way to find the child. He thought about going to St. Helens. It might be his only shot. He then thought of something else and looked back up at Flora.
"Harry, I never see you this way," she said.
"I know, Flora," he said. "I'm sorry, I don't like dead ends. Can you bring me the reels with births in January and February 1951, please?"
"You sure? You got a lot of births in 2 months."
"Yes, I'm sure."
"Okay, then."
Flora disappeared again, and Bosch went back to the microfilm cubicle to wait. Checking his watch, he realized that it was likely he would be looking through microfilm until the office closed at 5 o'clock. He would then face a brutal rush hour drive through the heart of downtown and up into Hollywood to get home, a slog that could take 2 hours. Since he was closer to Orange County than home, he decided to text his daughter on the off chance she'd have time for dinner away from the Chapman University student cafeteria.
Mads, I'm in Norwalk on a case. I could come down for dinner if you have time. She texted back right away. Where is Norwalk? Down near you. I could pick you up at 5:30 and have you back doing homework by 7. What do you say? Her decision did not come quickly.